Hey everybody, J.M. Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership. Hope everybody's doing great on this Friday, and I have the pleasure of being with Faye Walsh-Drouillard from Dublin, Ireland. And Faye was introduced to me by my good friend Andrew Parrish in Ireland. And Faye, thanks for coming on with me today.
Thanks for having me, Jen. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So you have a very interesting background. We've interviewed over 200 guests on our podcast, the Leadership Podcast, and usually doing homework on people is pretty easy. And as I was doing homework on you, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of complexity of your experiences. So you start out at Sidwell in Washington, D.C., and you go from that Washington to UW, University of Washington in Seattle to school and got your bachelor's. Then UCLA for your MBA, and then what was your first job after graduating from undergrad?
So my first job actually, I was determined to work in some international capacity, which is maybe explains why I'm not living in the States anymore. I was on a mission to see the world. I actually got a job in fashion, import export, for about a year, and we were a supplier actually for the Gap and a bunch of other brands, but It was in San Francisco. It was during that first tech boom. I didn't really want to be part of that, but I was having great fun learning about what I guess is now referred to as fast fashion. And when I look back on it, I think, wow, I would have loved to have changed a few things there. So that was my first job out of college. Although I have to say, I always was working ever since I was young. I worked all through college, even through undergrad. Minimum of 20 to 30 hours a week. So even though that was my first full-time job, it certainly wasn't my first job.
Right. Well, and you've been a consultant since 2008. You're with Starfish Impact, board member with Philanthropy Ireland, ChangeX, Community Foundation of Ireland, Giving Circle of Amsterdam and Ireland. And you're an angel investor with Halo Business Angel Network that works with Enterprise Ireland, Invest Northern Ireland, and InterTrade Ireland, and you're a founder at Wake Up Capital. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of, I mean, I don't find many people that have their hands in that many things. How do you keep track of it all?
I'm just tired hearing you list all those things. I'm like, how am I doing all that at once? Well, I guess I have what you would call a portfolio career, and I have I have an extremely curious person. So I love to learn about all kinds of things. And of course, many of those roles are not full-time. You know, they would be volunteer roles. But I just have a real appetite for getting to the why and understanding how things work. And I like to do that by getting really involved. But I would say that the work that I do the pro bono work that I do on behalf of the philanthropic sector and the venture philanthropic sector really feeds into sort of some of the professional consulting work I've done. They sort of have a nice marriage there. And I guess I have this real belief that I know a lot of people maybe value people's careers based on their career path and going in a very linear fashion. But for me, it's the diversity of those roles gives me really unique perspectives. And I think helps make me a better consultant and also a better investor and a better supporter of the businesses in which I'm involved. So I also manage two rental income properties, which I didn't list on there because I don't feel the need to advertise it. But I think by nature, I'm a multitasker. And I think, as my mother always says, you know, whenever Faye's a bit bored, we get worried.
Yeah.
About what's going to happen next. So I get enormous satisfaction, but I think a lot of it has to do with multitasking, which is certainly a feminine quality, but certainly one that I embrace. But I love it. If I have a few minutes free, watch out.
Yeah. Well, you said something about, you know, boy, if you had to do fast fashion differently, you would do it differently. I have a feeling I know what you're going to say, and it probably ties into the theme or the what all these organizations have in common that align with your values.
Yeah.
Can you say more about that?
Absolutely. I actually decided at very young age that I really believed that you could do good and do well at the same time. And I kept trying to test that philosophy over, I guess it's probably why I've also tried different kinds of work. I really believe that when you have purpose in what you're doing And if it aligns with your values, you enjoy it more. And if you can find and carve out a place for yourself, and that certainly works for me. I also have a really hard time working in an environment or working on behalf of a sector or even working for someone with whom I don't share values, or where I see it's not actually, because I'm constantly looking into the future. Like, what? Okay, this is today. This is what we're working on today. I'll give you an example. I worked in one of the biggest firms in LA, one of the biggest LA law firms, in mergers and acquisitions as a paralegal. And we were working on these massive, big deals, you know, companies buying other companies, which of course is very relevant and important. But I would sit there and think, how is this actually going to make the world better? Or if it was big litigation and we would be going through some case and I'd be reading through transcripts, I would really have to sit there and say, how is my work today actually going to leave the world better when I'm gone? And if I couldn't answer that question, I found I would just get bored and frustrated. I'd want to take the whole place over, which didn't really work that way during your paralegal.
You know, we had Tom Rath on the podcast who wrote Strength Finders, and he also wrote a book on Life's Great Question. Oh, you got it up there. Yeah, he was one of our favorite guests. And, you know, one of the things he asked was, what is the one thing you can do today that will have a lasting impact, you know, tomorrow? And, you know, that you're really thoughtful about that. You know, so I'm wondering if you can provide maybe an example. You know, you've got the Halo Business Angel Network, and, you know, most Americans might not understand the complexity between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And you're working with basically trade groups, Enterprise Ireland, Invest Northern Ireland, to try to bring investors into Ireland and to help with exports out of Ireland. Can you just talk about, you know, how you go about deciding what's a good fit and how it fits in with your values and how that might work that's different than the US?
Absolutely. Well, I will say first and foremost, I wasn't involved in angel investing in the US, so I can only sort of extrapolate. I was involved in more like venture philanthropy, or, you know, social enterprise. But in terms of comparison, first and foremost, Ireland is an excellent place for startups for a number of reasons. It's a great hotbed for testing business models. It's a small country. It's just less than 5 million people. But it has real muscle and a real, it's developed some great acumen for entrepreneurs. And a lot of that has to do with things that have developed over the last 30, 40 years. You know, obviously being part of the EU and having a really interesting tax incentives brought over all these great corporations. And then with those great corporations, you get talent. Of course, there was already talent here. You have a strong education system, English speaking country in the EU. And the Irish are survivors. They're incredible, incredible people who have been resilient over time. So I think you add all those things together and you make for a great environment. Obviously, within the island of Ireland, it's relatively complex, especially in a time like now. But it's small, and, you know, the opportunity to move back and forth over the border is really interesting. And then there's a natural correlation and a relationship back over with the UK as well. And when I mean UK, over into London. But what I think, what I look for is I'm an impact investor, right? So I screen for companies who are going to have some demonstrable social and or environmental impact baked in their business model. So that's first and foremost. I also am often, while I'm not completely, don't publicize it, it ends up happening. I have a special feeling for female entrepreneurs, because I think a lot of times they have to work a heck of a lot harder to access capital. So I might have a bit more time for them. And they often impress me more anyway. I'll just say that out loud. But I think here, you know, if you are an Irish entrepreneur and you've been able to access some of the funding programs that are available, the Irish state is the biggest and, you know, a wonderful way of investing in enterprise. And I'd say in the US, entrepreneurs often are relying on private capital from start, maybe even to finish. Right. You're not accessing capital that's backed by the U.S. government. You might be accessing it, but for the most part, you could. So you're dealing with individuals, personalities, firms. Whereas here, there's really this lovely these lovely networks where the government has incentives for you to be an entrepreneur and also to be an incentive. So I find that those opportunities maybe are more wide-reaching than we would have in the U.S. On the other hand, a big difference is there's just a lot more money in America. And so I know as an American here, when I first arrived, you know, they hear American voice and, you know, sometimes they think, oh, let's find out, you know, Where is she from? What does she do? What does she have for us? And I mean, that's the reality. Americans and America is big business for Ireland, a huge second biggest export partner. So I think there's some really nice ways that the two countries can feed off of each other. But also it's a relatively complex with the North. It's not an obvious, you'd imagine there'd be a lot more crossover. I look at companies from Belfast from time to time, but not as often as I'd like. I probably look at more companies in London, which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got some questions about diversity, but we've got a couple of questions that have come in, and I'll throw it up on the screen. This is from Dane Hoffman. He's asking, would you feel fashion be more cured by creating better processes or instilling more purposeful culture?
Ooh, nice question, Dane. I have to go back 20 years to my fashion, very limited fashion experience. Although I have been looking at some fast fashion solutions, I actually think it's both. I think right now we're in a time where people are starved for purpose more than they ever have been. So, you know, these decades of conspicuous consumption may have created enormous, you know, margins and profit for people in high fashion and across fashion and fast fashion. But it's at what cost? At enormous cost. And so I think the way that we create products in fashion is unfortunately at the expense of our environment and also people. You know, when you think about some of the solutions for offloading fashion waste, may seem like a great idea, but in fact, we end up just putting a whole bunch of old clothes and shipping them to countries in Africa who don't actually want them. So, I mean, that's just one example. So I've seen some really interesting ideas of how to just change, for example, how we dye the indigo dye process for making jeans. How can we fix that? How can we grow cotton more sustainably, but teach the farmers who are actually growing the cotton to be more sustainable? But I think at the end, you also have to look at who's actually making decisions, who's infusing capital into those businesses, and who's buying the products at the end. And if there's not purpose in those parties, the system won't change. So I don't know if that's your question, but I'd say I want both. I have a big appetite for change.
Yeah. We had Vincent Stanley on the podcast who, is the chief storyteller and chief philosopher of the company Patagonia. And, you know, he talked a lot about organic cotton and, you know, that they really don't want people buying new clothes. And it's a really, and they've written a book, it's up on the shelf, called The Responsible Company. And just, I'll put it out there to anyone listening, a really great book. If you've in a company and you want sort of some guidelines and checklists about how to be a responsible company, it's a good one. Here's another question from past guest on our show, David Ortiz, who's running for House District, I think 38 or 37. David will correct me, in Colorado this November. He's asking, did you have to come to that realization, or have you always known that about yourself and always worked with and for organizations that align with your values? That's a good question.
Great question, David. And I know the answer very well. And I was enormously influenced by my high school. Actually, it was my middle school and my high school. This is, to me, where education can really turn a light bulb on for a young person. Having gone to a Quaker school in Washington, D.C., that espoused incredible commitment and values surrounding community service and sort of letting your life speak and letting finding your purpose early. That really went into my being when I was probably 12, 13, and it never left. So I think I've been on a bit of a journey to try to figure out what that actually means for me. And I've tested it out and even tried to sort of shake it off and say, you know, can't I just go and get a normal job and sort of leave this aside? But actually, no, it's really, it really is part of who I am. So I would commend sort of the Quaker philosophy. And also my upbringing with my parents. I think I'm really lucky to be born into a family that really valued good education, but also, you know, they weren't sending me off to go and, you know, make tons of money at all costs. It was really more about following my instincts for equality and justice, which is, of course, the work I've done in Long Beach with the Freedom Riders Foundation. And I continue to use to have those values direct what I do today. So it was very early. And to me, that's just a demonstration of the power of education.
Yeah. You know, I've often said that, you know, when you understand what your values and they're prioritized, it makes decision making easy. We work with a lot of veterans that are leaving the service and they're trying to find jobs and, you know, they're thinking, boy, if I need to get a job. I just need to get a job. And you know, a lot of what they're being directed to do is to, you know, write a resume and send it off, and it's a numbers game. And we always suggest that, you know, they take a real step back and really figure out what do they value, and who are, where can they find people that have those similar values, that that's more important than the company, the industry, you know, all the money, all those things. So it's easy to say, you know, but it was there ever a point in your life where it was a hard decision that you had sort of competing values and they bumped up against each other and really tested you?
Absolutely. actually, I think of a turning point. I guess we all have these moments, these snapshots in time where your life kind of goes one way. It could have gone another way. I was working in Paris at that law firm. I got transferred over from Los Angeles to Paris. And I was still considering going to law school, by the way, at this time. And I had this incredible volunteer opportunity to work with this wonderful leader, Aaron Gruel, who is the leader of the Freedom Writers Foundation. And if you haven't seen the film, you should. That came out in 2007. And she had been trying to recruit me to come back and help her with the continuation of her work. But I kept saying, you know, I was thinking about going to law school, but now I think I want to go to business school. So I'll come and I'll help you. But I really want to get my MBA. So I'm going to help you with this lovely student-led project you're doing. But I really need to now go and get my MBA so I can, you know, go off and, you know, find my fortune or whatever it was at the time. So, you know, that was going to be a 6-month arrangement. And 6.5 years later, I am helping to run the organization, but I did get my MBA in the process. So that was helpful. So that was one of those times where I really was struggling to figure out what was the right thing to do. But when I got into that world and I was working with those incredible freedom riders and students who were overcoming adversity that I had never seen in my life, but they were still able to function, I felt like, well, maybe I can put this together, my business mind and my values. And that's what I did.
Yeah, good. Well, we've got another question that came in about entrepreneurship. Sure. And, you know, my experience in Ireland is, and this is more so 10 or so years ago, to fail was considered a big black mark, that, you know, if you failed, you know, you were done. So a lot of the entrepreneurs early on were older. They'd already achieved a certain amount of success, had money, and you didn't see a lot of younger folks, because they didn't want to basically, you know, crash and burn early in their career. They didn't feel that they could recover.
Yeah.
In the U.S., a lot of people that are transitioning, maybe from the military or from different things, think, boy, I'd love to be an entrepreneur, but I don't know what my product or my idea is. They don't even know where to start. And now in hindsight, I think, you know, betting on yourself is the best insurance ever, rather than putting your fate in someone else's hands. So what advice might you have for people that, you know, think that entrepreneurship is appealing, yet, boy, it's scary.
Yeah. It's scary, but it's really fun. I would say, you know, if you enjoy it, stick with it. It's probably not for the faint of heart, but it is really fun and it's addictive. I don't know. You mentioned, you know, I about a product or service. I actually think you really have to start with the problem you're trying to solve. And that's what I start every conversation, every business I look at. What is a nonprofit? It doesn't have for-profit, nonprofit, social enterprise. What is the problem we are trying to solve? And is it a problem that you really know something about to the point that you can actually come up with a solution? And is it a problem other people, customers, businesses are experiencing? And to me, then you work backwards from there and around to a solution. But it has to start with the problem you're trying to solve, because otherwise, you know, you're just coming up with kind of relatively random ideas that are maybe not substantiated. So that to me is a great place to think of things, think of challenges that you see around you. I think, and if you really want to know, I think people who have given time in the armed services are some of the best equipped entrepreneurs, because that's all they do is solve problems.
And I would add, Faye, that, you know, not just figuring out what the problem, you know, what the problems are and how to solve them, but being just innately curious about, you know, and broadly read, that you're seeing patterns, you're seeing connections. You know, as an executive coach, what's interesting during this pandemic is all my clients are all dealing with the same issues for the first time.
Yeah.
Before the pandemic, they all had lots of different issues. Now everybody's the same. And so I feel like every day I'm trying to figure out, what are the patterns? How do I help all these people? What are the things that they're all kind of struggling with? We had another question come in. I loved all these questions. This one's from Lita Citrone. And Lita, who's a personal brand expert, a dear friend, just a wonderful person who helps lots of veterans, she's asking, how do you, Faye, suggest someone uncover or unveil their set of values that can serve to filter and make decisions? So these came to you at Sidwell. You were very lucky to go to such a great school. What about others that aren't, don't have that same opportunity and experience?
Well, I think this is a really interesting time for people to be reflective. And I think, like you said, we're sort of having a universal experience, at least those of us who are dealing with this COVID experience. And it's putting a highlight on what's really important to people. And I think asking that person to ask themselves some really tough questions of, you know, what are you willing to give up? What are you willing to give up? What are you willing to give up? What are things that you could just say goodbye to tomorrow? Because right now, many people are in a situation where they're struggling to just get the basic needs met. And that's when you start to really understand, of course, what you value and what's important, but it also shows how you respond in a challenging situation. So to me, it's a bit of self-reflection and thinking about, yeah, what are you willing, what can you live without? What are you willing to give up? But also, you know, and I use this line for Wake Up Capital, like, what kind of world do you want to wake up to tomorrow? You know, how would you make things different? I find this period of time, people either, it's fight or flight. People are either hiding away and really upset and, you know, just frustrated and feeling helpless, or they're coming out ready to be part of a solution. So I think a self-reflection in this kind of a time to think about, what are you willing to give up? What kind of world do you want to wake up to? And how can you be part of that effort, that new vision that you have in mind? I also think you can't teach people to have values, right? You can't force that upon them. You can't teach people to have, you know, humility or confidence or common sense. You know, it's something they have to kind of experience for themselves, I suppose. But I think understanding the consequences of not being guided by your values, then you see where trouble starts, which is, I think, why we're in such a challenging situation right now in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Clayton Christensen would describe that as a slippery slope. Interesting. Well, what you're really saying, what I'm hearing you say, is a lot of this requires sacrifice. You have to give up something. And part of it is it requires a certain degree of self-discipline. And, you know, we got another question here from David Ortiz, and he's asking about crossover from philanthropy to governance. So, you know, is that's the hard part, right?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to reverse his question around, because the actual order in which I did things is the reverse of the question. So I actually was involved in politics 20 years ago. I helped run a congressional campaign. I caught the bug. I worked also on a presidential campaign, and I also worked at the Democratic Convention. I'm just throwing it out there. In 2008, it was an exciting time. So. You know, politics is a tough one. So I might not go into too much detail there. And if I had really wanted to stick with it, I probably would have. But I'm obviously in a different country now. But in terms of governance and philanthropy, I actually got involved in governance when I was running a foundation, a business at the same time, and had to build boards and be part of a board and make very big decisions on behalf of lots of stakeholders. So to me, you know, the value of good governance came very soon, because it impacted directly me every day as a leader. I needed to be at the table understanding how the board was built, how they were going to make decisions, and how I could help guide them and how they could guide me. So that came quite early. And I had that role in my late 20s. So I was really, you know, forming myself. Then the movement over into philanthropy came because I realized that and I don't want to say it was a power struggle, but, you know, the decision to actually put the green light on for money to go to an organization was held by a very small number of people with not much diversity, but lots of power and lots of money. And I thought, if I could have influence on that end, maybe I could help change the consequences and the results for people who were asking for the money and raising the money. Because I know how hard it is to raise money. It's very hard. It's very complicated. Mm-hmm. But it's really nice to know if you're sitting at a table with your equal, as opposed to feeling like there's an imbalance. And I guess I've been on a mission to try to balance that out, as opposed to, we need money, we're a charity, we're an enterprise. And then the people with the money are sort of looking down and feeling very powerful. I wanted to look more as an exchange. Each person, mm-hmm. each side has something to give to the other. And how can you even the playing field for everybody? But the reality is it's not even. And the talent is universally distributed, but the opportunities are not. So yeah. I guess that's why I made the move over to philanthropy, but also continue to stay at a board level, because when you're at a board level, you can have influence. You can mm-hmm. really have influence. And I feel that one of the roles that I try to play here in Ireland is to say the things that maybe the Irish would be afraid to say. I can claim my sort of American outspokenness, and I've seen real impact from that as well.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned something and it made me think about, the law of reciprocity. In Ireland, what I always say to students that I bring over is, we're not going over for the food or the weather or even the scenery. We're going over for the people. Relationships are really important there, and everybody knows everybody. Everybody, it feels like everybody's related. Yet in Dublin and Belfast, they're pretty international cities with pretty diverse populations, especially Dublin, with a lot of Eastern Europeans. What have you learned about this whole law of reciprocity? The whole idea of give more than you take, and what do you see as far as how you lead that when you see people, take more than they give?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, first of all, I'd say before I arrived here, and definitely from the work that I have done, my humility I feel like with humility, it's much easier to engage in a conversation. Again, you can't teach that, but it's something I really try to embody. I feel like I'm just like a little speck on of sand on a beach, right? And I see everyone equally, regardless. I think when you're coming to a country, when I came to a country like Ireland, who for hundreds of years, I'm going to sound Irish now, for 800 years, having been basically the victims of dominance by a colony, and also the oppression of the Catholic Church, there was always an imbalance. There was always a sense of being beholden to another power, another people. And that can really impact the way a culture thinks and the way they live. And there's a certain amount of resignation that is sort of embedded into the way that people think. But I think if you come here to Ireland and maybe to another place with an open mind and an open heart, and not coming to the table with a zero-sum game in mind, where I have something to take away from you, it's for my own gain, but actually I have something to give and maybe we will all benefit from it. I think that kind of attitude and that kind of way of behaving has really served me. But I can tell you, when I first arrived, you do have to kind of take your time to make it clear that what your intentions are. Mm. Because having the legacy that the Irish have, they have to look out for themselves to a certain extent. I think now they're in a much better place. But having that sort of openness and generous spirit, and understand that I want to see success on behalf of many people, not just for myself, it just continues to serve me well. I actually saw this fabulous poster. I was in California recently, and there was a sign on the wall, and it said, "Equal rights for others doesn't mean less rights for you. It's not pie." And this was a pie shop. I know that's around the equality movement in the States, but I just love this idea. It's not a zero sum game. Or another line that I love right now from a fabulous singer is, when I shine, we all shine. Just this idea that if I want to come in and bring my enthusiasm and my gifts, whether it's in funds or money or time, my intention is to help everyone around me. It's not to take and to take. That to me is something that's a trait and a behavior that I look for in other people. But I also think shows great leadership. I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but when I see a leader behaving that way, I think that's what I aspire to.
Mm. Who do you look to as leaders that you really admire?
Well, I'm just a big fan of Jacinda Ardern. I hope I pronounced her name properly, in New Zealand. I just think she's phenomenal. I really admire her. I like Angela Merkel. I just find, and is it coincidence that they're women? I don't know. I would love to say yet. I think so. Sort of a selfless, continued determination to serve others, and transparency, and an ability to build trust with people. and to own sort of those feminine skills and feminine traits that actually lend itself to leadership.
Yeah.
I like Kamala Harris too. I'm a fan. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, the I wanted the penultimate question for my time with you to be this one is how do you guide people to the source of their own power?
Okay. Well, I think one thing that I've said to my clients in the past, who, you know, when you're deep, and I have to use experience of business when people are in an early stage business, because I think that's a great time of a struggle and frustration when you're trying to be guided, you need to be guided in a way, or you may have your vision, but you need help from people around you. You know, trying to make life happen and not letting life happen to you. That's something that is, I would say, another way that I try to live. And I see it happen over and over. And again, I see it often happen with women as well. I don't want to make this entirely about gender, but it is a very important part of my identity, is this idea that things are happening to us all the time. And it's true. There's so many things coming at us and happening to us as individuals, as leaders, many things we cannot control. But many things we can. So I guess I try really hard to understand what are those things that I actually can control, and how can I make the best of the situation. And for the things that I can't control, at least I can control the way I respond to them. Mm-hmm. So trying to feel like you have a sense of empowerment, as opposed to being caught, you know, deer in the headlights. Oh my gosh, you know, how do I go from here? What do I do? Really going back and thinking, okay, well, in this situation right now, what do I know I can change? What can I control? And in the things I can't, what am I going to do with that? How am I going to work around it or above it or over it? That to me is kind of, those are some of the advice that I would give for people trying to find their own power. But, you know, some people also don't really want to be, you know, empowered. They want to be led by someone else. So you're obviously a leadership guru. But I think, you know, not everybody needs to be a leader. Some people, you know, the leaders also need the people who are going to follow them, and vice versa. So I think understanding, you know, where do you fit? Do you need that someone to lead you, or are you okay to be the leader and have people follow you? Sort of know where you fit in that relationship. And you don't have to be a leader. It's okay not to be.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate what you said about the what you control, you know, and how you respond to your environment. What about you know, responsibility or duty when it comes to, you know, that, you know, that we all have. I mean, you know, right, especially now, there's so much talk about, you know, that they should be doing this and they should be doing that. But there's also some people that are trying to lead by saying, you know, you have a duty, you have a responsibility for these particular things. And they could be civic, or they could be economic, they could be societal or philanthropic or community. What about that?
So I think, again, if self-reflection and recognizing what privilege we have, first of all, as humans being alive, but then breaking that down further, I feel enormous, and I own it as well, enormous privilege. Not the kind of privilege of wealth, it's not that. The privilege of being living in a democratic country with education, you know, have a certain amount of choice on how I want to direct my life, knowing that I have that privilege in the world compared to so many billions of people who are living in circumstances that are well beyond their control, but also in circumstances that are just honestly horrific, that we are in that tiny percentage of people who are privileged. I believe we all have a duty to make the best of that situation on behalf of other people, in whatever role that you play. And for me, it's as a board member, and also helping to direct funds in certain direction and giving of my time. But the duty of care is one that I think any one of us who is in a situation where we are free, have resources at our fingertips, and have either control of certain decisions or in charge of something, we have a duty of care to our fellow citizens, fellow humans, friends, family, because we live a beautiful, privileged life. It's not always easy, but for the most part, you know, we are of that percentage of people. And to me, when we go off into the next life, whatever that is, I can't imagine not trying to make the most of it in the time that you're here. And I am not actually a religious person, potentially a bit more spiritual. But I think for all of us who are in a position to be able to do something, not doing something is irresponsible. I think we all have to be a steward of our people and a steward of the planet.
Yeah. And the pandemic doesn't help because we're all limited in travel. And I believe that the more you travel, the more you come to appreciate, you know, some of these, what you said, privileges.
Yeah. Well, the pandemic, I would also mention, it's a challenge for us. And I would say the people who struggle the most are probably frontline workers and people who are actually suffering from it. But some of the challenges that we're up against are also, we're looking in a mirror saying, wait, the way that we've been living, maybe it's actually not sustainable. Maybe this is actually indicating that we need to figure out how to adapt. Maybe the planet's sending us a message.
Mm-hmm.
By not being responsible and not being a steward and not having a duty of care, this is what can happen. I'm not saying it's entirely our fault, but I do think this is a moment of history to take a pause. And we can look at who this is influencing. This is a first world developed nation issue for now.
Yeah. When we lead our expeditions, you know, the takeaway always is the same. So you've got to slow down to speed up. And by that, you know, it means, boy, it's really nice not having the cell phone with no signal and having time to reflect and kind of going back to what we started with, talk about, you know, hey, what do I really value? What's really important? How do I make a difference in the world? As we kind of wrap up today, Faye, first I want to thank you for giving your time and sharing, not only for the people that are listening live, but the people that will listen. What might be a challenge that you put out there for others, as something to think about or focus on? Again, going back to sacrifice and discipline.
Let's see. I would say, go back to my question that I ask, you know, when as we're launching Wake Up Capital, is like, what kind of world do you want to wake up to? And if you have issues about the way that you see the world today, either before COVID or now, or, you know, considering the current circumstances, write down three things that you actually could do tomorrow to improve it. Write down three things. And if you don't know what those three things are, go have a conversation with a family member or a friend and figure them out. And then try to accomplish them before the end of this year or even sooner. To me, that's it. Take action. Talk is so easy. It's so easy for us. There's so much information being thrown at us, so much commentary, but actually going and doing the work and making a decision to take action. And it can be as simple as getting involved in some of the incredible efforts to help make sure every voter is registered right now in the U.S. It could be to decide to allocate a portion of your own wealth to philanthropy, whatever percentage you're comfortable with. It shall not be judged by the amount. Or else go out and think of somebody who might be struggling in whatever way and see how you can help them. Because I've learned so much about who I am by helping others.
Yeah. Well said, Faye. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's my pleasure, Jen. It was fun. Anytime.
All right. Great.
Cheers.
Cheers.